Chapter 3. The preceding squib was assailed in the North American Review in an article entitled Mark Twain and Paul Burgett, by Max Orell. The following little note is a rejoinder to that article. It is possible that the position assumed here that M. Burgett dictated the Orell article himself is untenable. You have every right, my dear M. Burgett, to retort upon me by dictation, if you prefer that method to writing at me with your pen. But if I may say it without hurt, and certainly I mean no offense, I believe you would have acquitted yourself better with the pen. With the pen you are at home. It is your natural weapon. You use it with grace, eloquence, charm, persuasiveness, when men are to be convinced, and with formidable effect, when they have earned a castigation. But I am sure I see signs in the above article that you are either unaccustomed to dictating, or are out of practice. If you will re-read it, you will notice, yourself, that it lacks definiteness, that it lacks purpose, that it lacks coherence, that it lacks a subject to talk about, that it is loose and wobbly, that it wanders around, that it loses itself early, and does not find itself anymore. There are some other defects, as you will notice, but I think I have named the main ones. I feel sure that they are all due to your lack of practice in dictating. Inasmuch as you had not signed it, I had the impression at first that you had not dictated it, but only for a moment. Certain quite simple and definite facts reminded me that the article had to come from you, for the reason that it could not come from anyone else without a specific invitation from you or from me. I mean, it could not accept as an intrusion, a transgression of the law which forbids strangers to mix into a private dispute between friends, unasked. Those simple and definite facts were these. I had published an article in this magazine, with you for my subject, just you yourself. I stuck strictly to that one subject, and did not interlude any other. No one, of course, could call me to account but you alone, or your authorized representative. I asked some questions, asked them of myself. I answered them myself. My article was 13 pages long, and all devoted to you. Devoted to you, and divided up in this way. One page of guesses, as to what subjects you would instruct us in, as teacher. One page of doubts, as to the effectiveness of your method of examining us and our ways. Two or three pages of criticism of your method, and of certain results which it furnished you. Two or three pages of attempts, to show the justness of these same criticisms. Half a dozen pages made up of slight fault findings with certain minor details of your literary workmanship, of extracts from your outremer and comments upon them. Then I closed with an anecdote. I repeat for certain reasons that I closed with an anecdote. When I was asked by this magazine if I wished to swear a plea to that article of mine, I said yes, and waited in Paris for the proof sheets of the plea to come. I already knew, by the cablegram, that the plea would not be signed by you, but upon reflection I knew it would be dictated by you, because no volunteer would feel himself at liberty to assume your championship in a private dispute, unasked, in view of the fact that you are quite well able to take care of your matters of that sort yourself, and are not in need of anyone's help. No, a volunteer could not make such a venture. It would be too immodest. Also too gratuitously generous. And a shade too self-sufficient. No, he could not venture it. It would look too much like anxiety to get in at a feast where no plate had been provided for him. In fact, he could not get in at all, except by the back way, and with a false key. That is to say, a pretext invented for the occasion by putting into my mouth words which I did not use, and by wresting sayings of mine from their plain and true meaning. Would he resort to methods like those to get in? No, there are no people of that kind. So then I knew for a certainty that you dictated the reply yourself. I knew you did it to save yourself manual labor. And you had the right, as I have already said, and I am content, perfectly content. Yet it would have been little trouble to you, and a great kindness to me, if you had written your reply all out with your own capable hand. Because then it would have replied, and that is really what a reply is for. Broadly speaking, its function is to refute, as you will easily concede. That leaves something for the other person to take hold of. He has a chance to reply to the reply. He has a chance to refute the refutation. This would have happened if you had written it out instead of dictating. Dictating is nearly sure to unconcentrate the dictator's mind when he is out of practice, confuse him, and betray him into using one set of literary rules when he ought to use a quite different set. Often it betrays him into employing the rules for conversation between a shouter and a deaf person, as in the present case, when he ought to employ the rules for conducting discussion with a fault finder. The great foundation rule and basic principle of discussion with a fault finder is relevancy and concentration upon the subject, whereas the great foundation rule and basic principle governing conversation between a shouter and a deaf person is irrelevancy and persistent desertion of the topic in hand. If I may be allowed to illustrate by quoting example IV, section from chapter X, of Evised Rules for Conducting Conversation Between a Shouter and a Deaf Person, it will assist us in getting a clear idea of the difference between the two sets of rules. Shouter. Did you say his name is Weatherby? Deaf person. Change? Yes, I think it will. Though if it should clear off, I, shouter. It's his name, I want his name. Deaf person. Maybe so, but it will only be a shower, I think. Shouter. No, no, no. You have quite misunderstood me. If, deaf person. Ah. Good morning, I am sorry you must go. But call again, and let me continue to be of assistance to you in every way I can. You see, it is a perfect codec of the article you have dictated. It is really curious and interesting, when you come to compare it with yours, in detail, with my former article to which it is a reply in your hand. I talked 12 pages about your American instruction projects, and your doubtful scientific system, and your painstaking classification of non-existent things, and your diligence and zeal and sincerity, and your disloyal attitude towards anecdotes, and your undue reverence for unsafe statistics and far facts that lack a pedigree, and you turn around and come back at me with 8 pages of weather. I do not see how a person can act so. It is good of you to repeat, with change of language, in the bulk of your rejoinder, so much of my own article, and adopt my sentiments, and make them over, and put new buttons on, and I like the compliment, and am frank to say so, but agreeing with a person cripples controversy, and ought not to be allowed. It is weather, and of almost the worst sort. It pleases me greatly to hear you discourse with such approval and expansiveness upon my text. A foreigner can photograph the exteriors of a nation, but I think that is as far as he can get. I think that no foreigner can report its interior. And you say, colon, a man of average intelligence, who has passed 6 months among a people, cannot express opinions that are worth jotting down, but he can form impressions that are worth repeating. For my part, I think that foreigners' impressions are more interesting than native opinions. After all, such impressions merely mean how the country struck the foreigner. Apostrophe, which is a quite clear way of saying that a foreigner's report is only valuable when it restricts itself to impressions. It pleases me to have you follow my lead in that glowing way, but it leaves me nothing to combat. You should give me something to deny and refute. I would do as much for you. It pleases me to have you playfully warn the public against taking one of your books seriously. When I published Jonathan and His Continent, I wrote in a preface addressed to Jonathan, colon, if ever you should insist in seeing in this little volume a serious study of your country and of your countrymen, I warn you that your worldwide fame for humor will be exploded. Because I used to do that cunning thing myself in earlier days. I did it in a prefatory note to a book of mine called Tom Sawyer. Notice. Persons attempting to find a motive in this narrative will be prosecuted. Persons attempting to find a moral in it will be banished. Persons attempting to find a plot in it will be shot. By order of the author per GG, Chief of Ordnance. The kernel is the same in both prefaces. You see, the public must not take us too seriously. If we remove that kernel, we remove the life-principle, and the preface is a corpse. Yes, it pleases me to have you use that idea, for it is a high compliment. But it leaves me nothing to combat, and that is damage to me. Am I seeming to say that your reply is not a reply at all, M. Burgett? If so, I must modify that. It is too sweeping. For you have furnished a general answer to my inquiry as to what France through you can teach us. How could France teach America? Exclaims Mark Twain. France can teach America all the higher pursuits of life, and there is more artistic feeling and refinement in a street of French workingmen than in many avenues inhabited by American millionaires. She can teach her, not perhaps how to work, but how to rest, how to live, how to be happy. She can teach her that the aim of life is not money-making, but that money-making is only a means to obtain an end. She can teach her that wives are not expensive toys, but useful partners, friends, and confidants, who should always keep men under their wholesome influence by their diplomacy, their tact, their common sense, without bumptiousness. These qualities, added to the highest standard of morality, not angular and morose, but cheerful morality, are conceded to French women by whoever knows something of French life outside of the Paris boulevards, and Mark Twain's ill-natured sneer can, not even so much as stain them. I might tell Mark Twain that in France a man who was seen tipsy in his club would immediately see his name cancelled from membership. A man who had settled his fortune on his wife, to avoid meeting his creditors, would be refused admission into any decent society. Many a Frenchman has blown his brains out, rather than declare himself a bankrupt. Now would Mark Twain remark to this? An American is not such a fool. When a creditor stands in his way, he closes his doors, and reopens them the following day. When he has been a bankrupt 3 times, he can retire from business. It is a good answer. It relates to manners, customs, and morals, 3 things concerning which we can never have exhaustive and determinate statistics, and so the verdicts delivered upon them must always lack conclusiveness, and be subject to revision. But you have stated the truth. Possibly, as nearly as anyone could do it, in the circumstances. But why did you choose a detail of my question which could be answered only with vague hearsay evidence, and go right by one which could have been answered with deadly facts? Facts in everybody's reach, facts which none can dispute. I asked what France could teach us about government. I laid myself pretty wide open, there. And I thought I was handsomely generous too, when I did it. France can teach us how to levy village and city taxes which distribute the burden with a nearer approach to perfect fairness than is the case in any other land, and she can teach us the wisest and surest system of collecting them that exists. She can teach us how to elect a president in a sane way, and also how to do it without throwing the country into earthquakes and convulsions that cripple and embarrass business, stir up party hatred in the hearts of men, and make peaceful people wish the term extended to 30 years. France can teach us, but enough of that part of the question. And what else can France teach us? She can teach us all the fine arts, and does. She throws open her hospitable art academies, and says to us, come and we come, troops and troops of our young and gifted, and she sets over us the ablest masters in the world and bearing the greatest names, and she teaches us all that we are capable of learning, and persuades us, and encourages us with prizes and honors, much as if we were somehow children of her own, And when this noble education is finished, and we are ready to carry it home, and spread its gracious ministries abroad over our nation, and we come with homage and gratitude, and ask France for the bill there is nothing to pay. And in return for this imperial generosity, what does America do? She charges a duty on French works of art. I wish I had your end of this dispute. I should have something worth talking about. If you would only furnish me something to argue, something to refute, but you persistently won't. You leave good chances unutilized, and spend your strength in proving and establishing unimportant things. For instance, you have proven and established these 8 facts here following a good score as to number, but not worthwhile. Mark Twain is 1. Insulting. 2. Sarcastically speaking, his refined humor, 3. Prefers the manure pile to the violets. 4. Has uttered an ill-natured sneer. 5. Is a stee. 6. Needs a lesson in politeness and good manners. 7. Has published a ST article. 8. Has made remarks worthy of a gentleman. T is more funny than his Mark Twain's necked, and would have been less insulting. A quoted remark of mine is a gross insult to a nation friendly to America. He has read La Terre, this refined humorist. When Mark Twain visits a garden, he goes in the faraway comer, where the soil is prepared. Mark Twain's ill-natured sneer can, not so much as stain them, the French women. When he, Mark Twain, aches his revenge, he is unkind, unfair, bitter, nasty. But not even your nasty article on my country, Mark, etc. Mark might certainly have derived from it M. Burgett's book, A Lesson in Politeness and Good Manners. A quoted remark of mine is worthy of a gentleman. These are all true, but really they are not valuable. No one cares much for such finds. In our American magazines we recognize this and suppress them. We avoid naming them. American writers never allow themselves to name them. It would look as if they were in a temper, and we hold that exhibitions of temper in public are not good form except in the very young and inexperienced. And even if we had the disposition to name them, in order to fill up a gap, when we were short of ideas and arguments, our magazines would not allow us to do it, because they think that such words sully their pages. This present magazine is particularly strenuous about it. Its note to me announcing the forwarding of your proof sheets to France closed thus for your protection. It is needless to ask you to avoid anything that he might consider as personal. It was well enough, as a measure of precaution, but really it was not needed. You can trust me implicitly, M. Burgett. I shall never call you any names in print which I should be ashamed to call you with your unoffending and dearest ones present. Indeed, we are reserved, and particular in America to a degree which you would consider exaggerated. For instance, we should not write notes like that one of yours to a lady for a small fault or a large one. When M. Paul Burgett indulges in a little chaffing at the expense of the Americans, who can always get away with a few years trying to find out who their grandfathers were, he merely makes an allusion to an American foible. But, forsooth, what a kind man, what a humorist Mark Twain is when he retorts by calling France a nation of bastards. How the Americans of culture and refinement will admire him for thus speaking in their name. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.